in elastic scattering. So just to summarize, what we considered is we had an electron beam hitting a proton. And then it fragments inelastically in all kinds of hadronic states. What we computed, assuming that we knew nothing about quarks inside of the hadrons, we computed the differential cross section, the doubly differential cross section for inclusive scattering for the cross section to go to any final states, x versus dx dy. What we found is that this was equal to 2 pi alpha squared, the electromagnetic constant squared, times S, the center of mass energy squared. And we had Q to the fourth. And then the answer depended in general on these two unknown functions, which we called F1e, X and Q squared, times X, Y squared, plus 2 F2e, X and Q squared, 1 minus Y. In general, because we didn't know anything really about hadronic physics or how this process worked, we don't know anything about these functions. But just putting in Lorentz invariants and restricting the form of the hadronic tensor that entered into this matrix element, we're able to restrict the dependence on the hadronic physics to two unknown functions, which depended on these two variables, since for inelastic scattering, we argued that there's two independent kinematic variables. OK, so this is the general results. But then what we did is we computed it, again, in the parton model, assuming that we have quarks and using the magic of factorization. And what we found what we found in the parton model was that we could compute these functions in terms of the initial distribution of quarks inside of the proton. So then using the parton model, which is it's just QCD at leading order in alpha S. What we found is that F1 of x and q squared was equal to the sum over all of the quarks inside of the proton times their charge squared in units of E times this function fq of x, which described how likely it is to find a given quark q with momentum fraction x inside of the proton. And then we also found F2 of x and q squared, which was just equal to x times F1 of E of x. OK, so that's what our result was. The important points that we mentioned were, first of all, F1 and F2 only depend on x. That's this feature known as Bjorkian scaling, which tells us that we're scattering off of point-like constituents, which are free inside of the proton. For inelastic scattering, in general, you have two kinematic variables. So the fact that we only have one tells us that we're dealing with fundamentally elastic scattering. And then the other relation is that we have a relation between F1 and F2, which ends up coming about because quarks have spin 1/2. And that's just what we get from doing the calculation. So I want to talk a little bit more about these functions f, because these are very important. So these functions f are called parton distribution functions. Also known as PDFs. Um, So when I say sum over quarks inside of the proton, you might just say, well, a proton is a U, and a D. So I should sum over those. That's not right. Too simplistic. So when you write proton is equal to U, U, D, these quarks are only the valence quarks. But there's also other quarks inside of the proton called C quarks. Where do these come from? So there are also Q, Q bar pairs that fluctuate out of the vacuum. So, these are called C quarks. So what's the picture? Let's say I have a proton, and here are the valence quarks, U, D, D. All right. And so these quarks, the proton's moving along. So the quarks are going along like this. What can happen, as it's going along, there are continuously strong interactions going on, right? Because it's a hadron, there's a continuous, continuous cloud of strong particles constantly being emitted and absorbed by the proton, by the particles in the proton. Since the alpha S inside the hadron is very large. So I could think of these things as emitting gluons and absorbing gluons constantly like this. You might have even gluon interactions going on. Or I could have a gluon interaction like this, and it could split into a QQ bar pair like this, which would then get annihilated and back into a gluon and get absorbed again. So here I could have, let's say, like a U and a U bar, like that. Or I could have other quarks, which are not even present in the valence quark counting of the proton. So I could have, like, for example, an S and an S bar fluctuating out of existence, out of the vacuum. And then, at the end of the day, the valence quarks are always the same, U, U, D. But if I measure, for example, the quark content of the proton here, there's going to be S quarks and S bar quarks in addition to the valence quarks. Or if I measure the quark content here, then I'll have, let's say, two U quarks in a U bar. And it's not even ambiguously clear, if I measure it here, which one is the valence quark U, this one, or this one, when I measure it. So it's not even well defined how to separate out valence quarks or C quarks. All right. A high energy photon can scatter with either valence or C quarks. So when I do this sum, delta Q FQ of X, the sums over all quarks. And antiquarks, including the C quarks and the valence quarks. There's also a PDF, a parton distribution function for gluons as well. The photon is not going to scatter off of gluons, but if I consider, let's say, two hadrons colliding with one another, I have to consider the parton distribution function for gluons, which could scatter. So there's also a PDF for gluons. which you would call it f sub g of x. Okay. But we don't need to include it in the sum, of course, because the gluon doesn't carry charge. So I'll just plot what these things look like, the PDFs for various particles, just so you have a feel. But again, this is non-perturbative physics, so what I'm plotting you comes from experimental data. It's not something that you would compute. So it's plotted as a function of x, and x goes between 1 to 0, but I'm going to plot it, or sketch it on a log plot. So I have 0.1, 0.01, and then I'll stop at 0.001, like this. And typically what people plot is not f of x, but x times f of x. I'm not exactly sure why. So here's what the u quark distribution looks like. It's kind of like something like this. All right. So this is for u. And then for d, it kind of looks like something like this. So that's d. And then we have d bar, which looks something like that. All right, d bar here. We have u bar. It looks very similar. There's also the s quark, something like this. And it's equal to the s bar distribution. Then there's also charm quarks inside of the proton. Looks something like that. It's also equal to the C bar contribution. There's also B quarks inside of the proton. And it's the same as the B bar distribution. There's very little top content, so I won't even draw that. And then there's also gluons, which looks like this. So this is gluons. So if you go to very, very low x, most of the momentum in the proton is carried by gluons. So gluons dominate the particles with very low momentum in the proton. But then at higher momenta, it's dominated by the valence quarks. OK, so that's what it looks like.
How do people measure the PDF of the gluon?
Yeah, right. Oh, how do they measure the PDF of the gluon? So what you'd want to do is, actually, I'm not really sure how they measure it. The way it enters into calculations is if you collide together two protons, for example, then you need to take into account the probability that two gluons will interact with one another. So that's what enters into that calculation. I'm not sure if that's the way that they actually measure it or not, but that's one way it enters into a calculation. How do they measure the PDFs for quarks? Well, they do deep inelastic scattering. That's how they get it. All right, so I'll just repeat what I just said. High momentum partons are mostly valence quarks. And low momentum partons are mostly gluons. And then the heavier the quark is, the less and less you have of it inside of the proton, which intuitively kind of makes sense. Heavy quarks do exist, but they're more and more rare the heavier they are. So that's basically the whole story that I wanted to say. But I just wanted to mention, so we've gone through this deep inelastic scattering story from the point of view of explaining why or how we know that quarks exist inside of hadrons, even though we can't see quarks directly, free quarks. So that was the motivation. But along the way, we learned how to do essentially collider physics, right, at high energies. So I just want to write down the prescription because we'll come back to it soon enough. So what you want to do is if you're doing collider physics at high energies, so let's just say how to compute hadronic cross-sections . So this means that the center of mass energy will be much, much greater than the proton momentum squared, and the momentum transfer would also be much greater than the momentum than the proton mass. All you need to do is compute the parton level cross section and then you just integrate over the appropriate PDFs. So let me just say f sub I, and then we would just sum over I. So that's all you do.
Is there any rationale why gluon dominates the low momentum transfer?
There probably is, but I don't really know. So I think it's just because the strong coupling constant is so large. There are so many gluons that are constantly being emitted, very, very low momentum gluons that are constantly being emitted and absorbed. And so it's that huge population of gluons which is dominating the PDF. OK. So now we're going to change gears a little bit. What we're going to talk about now for the next two lectures is the Higgs. So the Higgs was discovered like just a few years ago at CERN. So CERN, of course, is a PP machine. And so what we're going to do is compute the properties of the Higgs, and then we're going to compute how it was produced at CERN through PP collisions. So again, we're going to have to go back to this parton model for calculating cross-sections. But before we do that, I just want to summarize kind of a brief history of the weak interaction and how it led to the standard model. So I probably could have done this at the beginning of class, but now that you understand more of the theoretical structure of the standard model, maybe it's also useful to think about it now, since we can appreciate some of the subtleties that were encountered along the way. So this is going to be very brief. In particular, I'm going to focus on the history of the weak interaction. If it weren't for the weak interaction, the standard model would just be the theory of electromagnetism and the strong interaction. There'd be no issue with having spontaneous symmetry breaking or having chiral interactions. The structure of the theory with massless gauge bosons would be totally well defined without any extra ingredients. So it's really the weak interaction which necessitated this whole story of having spontaneous symmetry breaking. So that's why the weak interaction is so important. So it started out in a long time ago, over 100 years ago, when radioactive beta decay was discovered. By Becquerel. Let's see if I can spell this right. Radioactive beta decay. A beta is just an electron that gets emitted by a decay. And so starting with some nucleus here, beta decays, it just emits an electron and gets converted into another nucleus. It was realized that this process violated energy conservation and angular momentum. So Pauli introduced the neutrino to solve those problems. So I should think of it like this, where I also emit an antineutrino. Then, just a few years later, Fermi proposed his theory of the weak interaction, which we wrote down. So Fermi's theory of course, he didn't know anything about quarks at the time, and so it was really just a theory of beta decay, which connected essentially a neutron to a proton, and then an electron, and then an antineutrino. So I'll just draw the line over here. All right, I can leave that off. So here's what he wrote down, but it's unknown what the Dirac structure was of this theory. All right.
What do you mean Dirac structure?
So what I wrote down on the when we talked about Fermi's four fermion theory, what we wrote down is that it had to have that structure of V minus A, V minus A. So it only coupled to the left-handed fields. Fermi, of course, didn't know that at the time. So he just wrote down effectively just a contact interaction between the neutron, the proton, electron, and neutrino like this. So it's unknown what Dirac matrices you put in between these different fields. OK. So the next very important development came in 1956. So there was a proposal by Li and Yang. And actually, this was following a suggestion by another person. Whose name is Martin Bloch. There, Li and Yang's proposal was that the weak interaction may violate parity. It was known at the time that the strong interaction and, of course, electromagnetism has to conserve parity, but there was no reason why the weak interaction should. And there are actually anomalies at the time which could not be understood assuming that the weak interaction conserved parity. So that was motivating the proposal. And then very soon after, parity violation was observed. In the weak interaction in beta decay by C.S. Wu in 1957. And the way that she observed this in her experiment is that she prepared a sample of atoms of cobalt 60. Which are unstable to decaying by beta decay. And she polarized these atoms. So let's say the spins of these atoms are all pointing down. And what she found is that when these nuclei underwent beta decay, they emitted their electrons preferentially going up. So the electrons from beta decay preferentially went this direction. So this violates parity, because you can imagine if you do the parity flipped version of this experiment, the spin will stay the same, but the momentum should point in the opposite direction. So this violates parity, so the weak interaction has to violate parity. So this is a very important fact. So P violation in the weak interaction necessitates chiral couplings between fermions. All right. And then the correct Dirac structure which was V minus A cross V minus A, what we wrote down before for Fermi's theory of the weak interaction. This structure was identified by studying lots of beta decay experimental data by Marshak, Sudarshan. Let's see if I spell that right. Yep. And then also by Feynman and Gell-Mann. All right. Okay. So there are a lot of weird theories about the weird features about the weak interaction, which I think we can appreciate. First of all, we show that it has a universal coupling, which suggests that it has a gauge symmetry explanation. It also needs a massive gauge boson, which is also problematic from the point of view of generating a renormalizable theory. And also, it has this structure and its couplings to fermions, which necessitates chiral couplings. And once you introduce chiral couplings to fermions, then you have trouble generating a masses for fermions in a way that's consistent with the gauge interaction. So putting all of those pieces together, it suggests that it's very difficult to explain the weak interaction using a gauge theory. But of course, this is circumvented using the mechanism, the Higgs mechanism, spontaneous symmetry breaking. So in 1963 and 1964, the idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking of gauge theories was introduced by Higgs, Braut, Ambler, and then also three other guys, Guralnik, who didn't receive a Nobel Prize, Hagen, and Kibble. And using this mechanism, it was shown how to give rise to the theory of the standard model, where the gauge symmetry is SU2 cross U1. So the standard model was proposed using this by Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg. All right. Okay, but the standard model by itself, with these ingredients, is theoretically consistent, but then it makes a number of predictions, right? So if the theory of weak decays is mediated by gauge bosons, we should be able to discover those gauge bosons, the W and the Z. So in 1983, the W and the Z were discovered at CERN. And then the last prediction, which is perhaps the most important of all, is that in order for the theory to be theoretically consistent, we need to go through this whole structure of giving masses to particles using the Higgs. And the prediction is that there should be one leftover degree of freedom, which is a scalar. And we should discover that, which we did. So 2012, the last remaining piece, the Higgs boson, was also discovered at CERN. Okay. All right. So now we're going to talk about the Higgs in more detail. So we're going to do Higgs decays. And also production. First, we're going to talk about decays. So the Higgs boson has the largest coupling. To particles that are the most massive. So those are the W, the Z, and the top. I just remind you what the masses are for all of these things. You have around 80.4 GeV, 91, I think 0.2, and this is around 173 GeV. So the mass of the Higgs is only 125. So around this. Again, we don't know why it has that value. It's a free parameter of the standard model, but that's what it is. So actually, the Higgs does not decay to any of these, cannot decay to any of these states where these are real states. So it can't produce two W bosons, for example, because it doesn't have enough mass. This is actually very good, because it's if the Higgs could decay into these three states, the Higgs decays would just be dominated by them. And so the only couplings we could ever hope to probe of the Higgs would be the couplings to these three particles. But because they're forbidden, we can actually study Higgs couplings to lighter states as well, in addition to the heavier states. So this is actually very useful. So it's very useful for studying the Higgs, since we can explore its couplings. To lighter fermions. As well as the heavy states. Okay. So. So what we're going to do to start out with, as a warm-up, we're going to consider the tree-level decays of the Higgs. So obviously, WW and ZZ are not allowed. TT bar is not allowed, but we can decay to other fermions as well. So we'll have H decaying into fermions. So let me just remind you what the Lagrangian is. It is 1 m psi over v h psi bar psi. So that's the Lagrangian. Psi is any fermion we want. There's its mass, and then divided by the VeV. So here is the Feynman rule. Higgs comes in, couples to psi bar psi. And the Feynman rule is minus I mass of the Higgs divided by V. So now we can compute the matrix element. So we have a minus I m psi over V. We have a U. Let me write the momenta here. So I'll call this momentum P, this momentum P prime. And this, let's say, is momentum Q. So I have U of P And then u, sorry, a v of p prime. I'm going to neglect the masses of psi. So I'm going to assume that I don't need to keep track of the masses here. The mass, of course, enters into the coupling. But that's just the coupling. I'm going to neglect the masses when I compute the cross-section. But it's not too hard to include it if you want. So I'll assume that m psi is much, much, much less than m Higgs, which is true if you're considering the bottom quark or any lighter quark. So now we'll sum over spins. So I don't need to average over spins because the Higgs just has spin 0. So I have m psi squared over v squared times 4 p dot p prime is what I get. And then I can write 2 times p dot p prime is equal to s, or I should say is equal to q squared, which is just the mass of the Higgs squared. Yeah?
Where exactly are you neglecting m psi?
Oh, okay. So what I want to do is, when I sum over spins, I should have the trace of p slash plus m psi, and then p slash prime minus m psi. So it's very easy to include these terms as well, but I think you can do it on your own. All right. So I have this, and I can rewrite using the fact that the mass of the Higgs squared is equal to q squared is equal to p plus p prime squared is equal to 2 p dot p prime. So this is just equal to m psi squared times 2 times the Higgs mass squared divided by the Bev squared. OK. So now we'll compute the decay rates, Higgs to psi psi bar. Now, I won't go through the two-body phase space integral. I'm sure that's already familiar to you guys. So what you get after you do the two-body phase space integral is 1 over 6 pi, the mass of the Higgs, times the sum over spins, times the matrix element squared. And if I just plug this in, I get m psi squared mh over 8 pi times v squared. So that's the result. So now let's plug it in and see how we do. Plug in the actual masses. That's really the beautiful thing about Higgs decays. Once the mass of the Higgs is fixed, and the masses of the fermions are fixed, and we know what G Fermi is, which fixes the VEV, everything is determined. So there's no other free parameters. And then we can compute the decay rate and just see how well does it agree with the prediction or not. So the standard model Higgs mechanism is very predictive. All right, so we should only consider the states that are lighter than the Higgs. So we have a couple to worry about. So for example, we have Higgs to tau, tau bar. This would be, OK, so there's m tau squared, mh over 8 pi b squared. And this ends up being around 0.26 MeV. OK. So, yeah?
What is the vacuum expectation value on the Higgs?
Yeah, it's 246 GeV. So we showed that V is equal to the square root of 2 times G Fermi to the minus 1/2 power, and that's around 246 GeV. When you plug in the measured value of G Fermi, the most precise way that G Fermi is measured is from muon decay. Okay. So that's what we get. This number agrees fairly well with what you find experimentally. And it ends up being about 6.3% in terms of the branching ratio. Branching ratio, just to remind you, is the partial width divided by the total width. Now, the other one to compute is we also have decays to quarks. And we don't have TT bar, but we have BB bar, which is MV squared MH 8 pi V squared. Just to test if you're paying attention, is there anything else I need to include? Huh?
Color.
Three, yes, color, thank you. You are awake. All right. So I have to include a 3 for color. Can decay to all three colors independently. And now when I plug in the mass of the bottom quark here, it's around 4.5 GeV. What I get is a number that's around 4.3 MeV. Now the experimentally measured value is that this is around 58% of the total width. So most of the time it's decaying into BB bar. And then lastly, we have Higgs decaying into CC bar. That's also important. So it's exactly the same formula as this, 3 MC squared MH squared over 8 pi V squared. And plugging in the mass of the charm quark, which is something like 1.5 GeV, you get 0.4 MeV. And then the branching ratio is around 2.9% here. This might look a little weird to you. This one is larger, but this one has a larger branching ratio. There's actually an effect which I haven't put in, which you need to modify these partial widths to get these numbers out at the end of the day. And that's an important effect due to the renormalization group running of the masses of these quarks. So you should think of these masses as parameters, and they're measured at the scale of their mass. So for example, the mass of the bottom quark is measured to be 4.5 GeV at the scale of its mass, around 4.5 GeV. But now, when the Higgs is decaying, you have to take into account the fact that the energy of this process is around 125 GeV. So you need to run the mass of this quark from 4.5 GeV all the way up to 125 GeV. That tends to decrease the mass of the quark by a significant fraction. So let me just put an asterisk by here. So these numbers, I haven't included the renormalization group effect. So I'll just mention what that is. So the renormalization group running of MC and MB decreases these masses. By a factor of around 2 for MC and 1.5 for MB. So that's what you get. Parametrically, it's decreasing by a factor of something like alpha S times the log of MH squared over M B squared or MC squared, something like this. So this is kind of the factor that you're introducing here. And because the mass of the charm is less than the mass of the B, that factor is larger for charm than it is for bottom. For the tau, you don't have to worry about that effect because it doesn't participate in the strong interaction. And so the renormalization group running of the tau mass is a lot smaller because it just depends on electromagnetic running. So I would replace that by alpha electromagnetic, which is a lot smaller number. It's only, I think, a few percent effect.
So far, we only have calculated tree level diagrams. How they come across? Like, is that very crucial to compare with the data?
Yeah, so this is, depends what you mean by quantum corrections.
The loop order.
Yeah, so there are loop decays. We're going to get to those very soon. I'm going to talk about one other thing first. So I think we'll do the loop decays on Friday. But those will be very important. We'll spend a long time talking about those. Okay. So now we are going to talk about, so those are the decays to two fermions. Let me also mention these decays, Higgs to WW and ZZ. I already told you that those are forbidden, but they can be allowed as long as one of the gauge bosons in the final state is not on shell. So it's just a virtual gauge boson. And so I should write it like this. So for example, I have a Higgs decaying into a WW, let's say, or let's do ZZ. So one of the Zs is real, but the other one is off shell. And then the Z will also decay, and it decays to two fermions. They don't have to be the same fermions on both sides, but so I have psi and psi bar, and then I'll have psi prime and psi bar prime. So this particular decay is actually a very, very good one for trying to discover the Higgs, because in this mode here, where I have H going to Z, Z star, and it goes to either E plus E plus E minus, or E plus E minus, mu plus mu minus, or mu plus mu minus, mu plus mu minus. These are all very effective ways to look for the Higgs, because leptons in the environment of a hadronic collider are very clean probes. So this is actually one of the main discovery channels for the Higgs at the LHC.
Why did you put star to one of the sets?
Yeah, so one of them is real and one of them is virtual. So virtual, you just indicate with a star.
So one of the Z is real Z, and it is also decaying to the other fermion.
Yeah. So I could. So for this one, I could omit this part of the diagram if you want. So this is a real state, and then these two are real states. So it's like a three-body decay. But I wrote it like this because the Z has a short lifetime, and it will also decay to two fermions. And you don't even know which one is real and which one is imaginary, or virtual, I should say. Yeah, both of them can also be virtual, but that ends up having a smaller rate. So processes with the fewer particles in the final state tend to be dominant over the ones with more particles in the final state. So the three-body final state will dominate over the two-body final state. Unless there's a reason why, such as it's forbidden kinematically. Okay, so this is one of the main discovery channels. At the Large Hadron Collider for discovering the Higgs. And the reason is that leptons are clean probes. Okay. Let me just write down what the branching ratios are in the decay partial widths are. We won't compute these, but you could. I think it's straightforward to do. It's just kind of messy. So this is turns out to be around 0.11 MeV, which ends up being around 2.6% expressed in terms of the branching ratio. And this one for WW is much larger. It's around 0.88 MeV. And so that is 22%. All right. So those are those channels. For the W decay, you can imagine it's a lot harder to find the Higgs, because for the W, you have to decay to either if you wanted to think about leptonic decays of the W, so it's decaying to leptons, you're always going to have a neutrino, right? And so you'll have neutrinos, which you don't see in your detector, so it's very hard to reconstruct what the mass of the Higgs is. If you want to look at hadronic decays of the W, so the W decaying into two quarks, which then lead to, you know, hadrons, that's also very difficult to reconstruct what the Higgs, reconstruct the Higgs or find the Higgs, because there's lots of events in the collisions that produce hadrons, and, you know, because there's lots of QCD processes as well going on.
Sorry, but you said that if the so you say electrons can be easily detected in a hadronic collider, right? So you can just find out what the missing transverse momentum is, so you would know where your neutrino went technically, right? If it's a two-body decay, you know that the dominant decay of the W plus is like E plus and then two neutrinos.
Yeah, I don't think it's so simple as that.
Okay. The electron is actually easy to spot, then there's not so much else that could happen, right?
Yeah, so the problem is you, I think if you only know like the missing transverse momentum, you don't, I think you still probably don't have enough kinematic information to reconstruct the mass of the Higgs. I think there's probably still some momentum information that you're losing. Okay, so almost out of time, but let me. But let's start setting up the problem for loop decays. Or let me mention what they are first.
Then people did not really use the H to WW star decay to study H.
Oh no, we can. It's just not one of the cleanest ways to study it. But now we can use all of these things. That's kind of the beauty of this value of the Higgs mass. We can really study all of these processes. So this one is more difficult to reconstruct, but it has a large rate. This one's very clean. And it has, you know, OK, it's a few percent. We can probe the BB bar coupling. We can probe the tau tau coupling. CC bar is very difficult to see, because there's lots of events that produce CC bar. And it's hard to distinguish charm quarks from other types of quarks in the hadronic environment. So that one is, might be too hard, but maybe people are thinking creatively for how to measure that one. Okay. But there's also other important channels which come from loop decays. There is Higgs to two gluons. So this one has a branching ratio, a partial width of around 0.35 MeV. So that ends up being around 8.6%. There's also Higgs to two photons, which ends up being having a width of 6 × 10⁻³. MeV, which is only 0.15%. There's also another one, which I won't discuss at all, Higgs to Z gamma. I didn't write down what its partial width is, but so I don't know. I think it's something of order this. But I won't discuss this one, but that's also a very interesting one. One thing you might wonder is, well, the photon and the gluon are massless, so how do we generate a coupling of the Higgs to these massless fermions, or sorry, these massless gauge bosons? Well, the answer is we do it at loop order. So although gluons and photons are massless, they couple to the Higgs at one loop order. And we're going to discuss this more. Now, the Higgs decay to two photons is another one that's very clean experimentally to see. But of course, it's very rare. But this was actually probably the most important mode for finding the Higgs. It was discovered, most of the discovery signal was in this channel of Higgs going into two photons, and you just add up the momentum of those photons and it equals the mass of the Higgs. The decay to two gluons is actually very, very difficult to see because in hadronic collisions, you're going to produce lots and lots of gluons. And so there's just not enough of the ones coming from the Higgs to be able to distinguish the signal compared to what you would find. But it turns out this process, or I should say the inverse process, where we have two gluons producing a Higgs boson, is actually the most important process for producing the Higgs. So even though this process or this rate is not relevant for seeing the Higgs and its decay, it's the most important thing for seeing it, seeing how it's produced.
Can we even see or generate the separate gluon out of quantum hadron? And how can we actually see the gluon out of really propagated gluon?
Yeah, so well, what you do, it's exactly the same thing as we did for deep inelastic scattering. You just compute the parton level cross-section for two gluons to produce a Higgs boson. And then you just integrate that over the parton distribution function of the gluons in the protons. Yeah?
So why are we talking about just decay channels? Why couldn't we collide two particles and look for a result around 1.5 GeV?
Yeah, so that's part of the story. So what you the way you want to think of it is you need to do it in two steps. First is how do you produce it, and then how can it decay? And so you have to combine both of those things when you try to think about what is it actually going to look like and what's the signal going to be. So we'll get to the production part later, but first we're just going to talk about how it decays. Yeah?
What do you really mean by Higgs decaying WW star is or ZZ star is that process, I mean, electron, like, because I'm not sure what it would mean for it to decay to a virtual particle.
Yeah, so I really mean it's really just a shorthand. So it's not really decaying, it's really a shorthand for Higgs decaying to a Z and then two fermions. Let's call it psi, psi bar, for example.
Yeah, and over there you can also have tau particles.
Oh, here, yes. Okay. So taus end up being a lot less clean for the purposes of finding the Higgs. And the reason is that the tau mainly decays into hadrons. So it decays into quarks mostly. So that will be contaminated by the fact that there's lots of quarks floating around at the LHC. Or if you restrict your attention to when the tau decays purely leptonically, it also produces neutrinos as well. So a lot of the momentum information in the tau will get lost because a lot of it is decaying into neutrinos. But thanks. Yeah, that's a good point. OK, so I'm going to stop there, and we'll continue with the loop decays tomorrow.